TV show. You know who does? A celebrity with a brand to sell and products to move. Trump golf courses and hotel rooms. Trump vodka and shirts. Trump ties, meat, magazine, and airline. Not to mention the ultimate snake oil salesman move, Trump University, which was essentially a traveling circus that pitched its tent in various hotel ballrooms across the country to take your money in turn for supposedly teaching you how to get rich selling real estate. Think about it. Why would a guy worth billions of dollars spend his valuable time hawking more products than Juliana Rancic on an HSN hydroxycut high? There's a reason you can't buy Warren Buffett beef or Lillian Betancourt lingerie or a Paul Allen guitar. Actual billionaires are busy all day, every day, taking care of business without going bankrupt. Trump claims declaring bankruptcy four times proves how smart he is. You know what's even smarter? Getting box-shaped women to buy a zillion bottles of skinny girl booze and selling the company to Beam Suntory for $120 million. Does that make Bethany Frankel a better business honcho than the Donald? When it comes to slinging swag, fuck yeah. And the way we're going, maybe Madam Bethany pouring Putin a skinny girl margarita in the Oval Office isn't such a pipe dream anymore. But just like Juliana, you gotta give Trump credit for embracing the power of TV. If a stick figure in designer denim can sell stretchy jeans to fat bucks, then surely an overfed orange man born with a silver foot in his mouth can sell himself as some kind of working class hero to the actual working class. No matter what you think about him, Trump was a master at communicating his message. He somehow captured the blue-collar imagination while sometimes hypocritically canceling out his own call to action. At his inauguration, a president who sells ties made in China ranted about other countries stealing American jobs to rabid supporters wearing Make America Great Again hats manufactured in Vietnam. You can't make this shit up. If we had tried a scene like that in Wag the Dog, movie critics would have declared it way over the top, as they would this one. A rich guy, who never swung a hammer in his life, gets elected by convincing people who make, transport, and swing hammers for a living that he actually has something in common with them. Without even a posed photo op of him in work clothes at a construction site, using any kind of hammer, or standing near a hammer, or even with his arm around Hank Aaron. The only claim he made toward working class credibility was when son Don Jr. talked about seeing his dad hang sheetrock at a work site one afternoon back in the 80s. I'd say the closest that Don Sr. ever came to touching sheetrock was putting his fist through a wall in Trump Tower on the day he discovered his bald spot. He got the guys who do hang sheetrock to believe in him. They saw Trump as a self-made man, which is remarkable considering his white-collar background. During the election process, he even admitted that it wasn't easy for him when he was starting out. He had to ask his father for a, quote, small loan of $1 million, unquote. Sorry, Don, but that ain't a tiny advance. The day I graduated from Emerson College, my dad gave me a greeting card with a $100 bill in it. That's what you call a small loan. And in my family, $100 was a lot of money. But you gotta hand it to him. Trump talked right to his audience. He promised them what they wanted to hear. He pushed all the proper buttons and got the desired response, much to many liberal chagrins. So now we have a reality star in the White House and one of TV Guide's 60 nastiest TV villains of all time, Omarosa, as a trusted aide. She started out in The Apprentice before working her way up to other classy showcases like alcohol-fueled bitch brawls on Girls Behaving Badly and slurping up slimy earthworms on Fear Factor. Now she works in the Oval Office sipping designer tea. So maybe it's time for us to rethink our election process, folks. Cut to the political chase. Update and eliminate. I'm using TV producer speak because I think that's what our current situation calls for. Not less reality TV. More, more, more. This is my proposal for future presidential contests. Let's literally turn the election into a contest. The seemingly endless 24-hour long-winded debates of the past political year proved nothing except how low we could all go. So let's stop pretending we're operating on some imagined higher plane. Step down into the gutter and face the fact. It's all just one giant shit show. And the shittier it gets, the higher the ratings. Trump gets called out for groping 11 women and comes to the next debate surrounded by former Bill Clinton rape accusers and the ratings go through the roof. Nobody was paying attention to what Trump and Hillary said about the economy that night. We were all too busy waiting for a bad episode of Empire to break out. Fuck the staid, old-fashioned approach. We need something new, and we need it to be entertaining television. Listen, we're Americans. We invented radio, TV, and the movies. Well, an Italian guy named Marconi invented the radio, but we added commercials and made it profitable. And some strange cat named Ed Weird, the word weird is right in his first name, my bridge, invented movies. But he only filmed horses running and people walking. We added the sex and guns and popcorn that made people really want to watch. And some Scottish nut named Logie Baird invented TV, but we added the game shows, dick jokes, and titcoms that really made it worthwhile. But we definitely invented reality TV, and we need to start using it to better effect. Right now, all it shows us is self-centered, spoiled narcissists willing to fuck, fight, and backstab their way to the top of the pile. In other words, perfect presidential material. No more political propaganda, no campaign commercials, no carefully controlled circumstances. Let's take Survivor, combine it with So You Think You Can Dance, add a dash of American Idol, and call it all the amazing new presidential race. Think of how exciting the 2016 election would have been if at the last second, live on international television, we got rid of the stiff, pre-planned, over-sterilized debates. Imagine the political pandemonium when both sides were given on-camera challenges they were unable to ask Donna Brazile or Roger Ailes for help with in advance. Could Hillary Clinton send a classified email from her iPad to the White House without having an Anthony Weiner dick pic involved? 30-second time limit. Would Donald Trump, armed only with a pack of Tic Tacs and Billy Bush, be able to spend 15 minutes in a room full of lingerie models without grabbing him by the pussy? Start the countdown. Could Hillary and Senator What's-His-Face dance the samba, make a pantsuit out of some palm fronds and chewing gum? Could Mike Pence attend a Wednesday matinee of Hamilton and then get several cast members to pray away the gay by the time the evening show began? We shall never know, but it would have been riveting television. And unlike the debates, this format will inform us better about who the candidates really are. Actions speak louder than words. Crisis doesn't create character, it reveals it. Live on TV, if I have my way, in 13 weekly episodes. Fuck the conventions, the super PACs, and the greedy trillionaire lobbyist cabals. The entire run of this show will cost less than Melania's monthly shoe budget. We stuff all the egos into a fancy house on August 14th, start sending them out on time-driven missions with chaotic surprises on September 28th, test their resolve with hidden cameras and sudden Hollywood-produced terror attacks on October 16th, and in between we heap potentially embarrassing personal revelations on them, delivered by special guest ex-friends, lovers, and litigious enemies from their past. It's an edge-of-your-seat thriller full of angst, real-time reactions, and genuine faux pas. I'd be a lot more enamored of Elizabeth Warren if she was running through the rainforest in a leather loincloth after stealing food from Sarah Palin's pup tent. I wouldn't be able to blink while watching Cory Booker and Kirsten Gillibrand face a Democratic dance-off against Alec Baldwin and his yoga-tuned wife. There are so many delicious viewing options. Mike Pence has to eat dinner, minus his wife, at a table full of liberal, attractive, pro-abortion women, without getting sexually aroused or quoting the Bible. Then again, maybe reciting Psalms is what gets him hot. Tune in and find out. Bernie Sanders has to buy a new suit and get it tailored. This will take much longer than you think. Caitlyn Jenner explains designer vaginas to Rand Paul with visual aids. Kid Rock beats Kamala Harris in a playlist playoff with his new country rap remix of the national anthem. Chris Christie wrestles with personal demons when a fresh platter of Krispy Kremes is placed on the Brooklyn Bridge and the only way to save them is by blocking traffic in both directions. Katy Perry tries not to fall asleep while Richard Dreyfuss discusses the making of Jaws and international diplomacy. Tulsi Gabbard outsurfs Dwayne Johnson in live, bloodthirsty, non-Spielberg sharks. Trump versus De Niro in a bamboo cage match. Ted Danson versus Ted Nugent. Oprah Winfrey versus James Woods. Bruce Springsteen versus Bruce Willis. Battle of the Bruces. It's all hosted by Dave Chappelle, with a panel of celebrity judges including Rush Limbaugh, Carrie Underwood, Mary J. Blige, and Howard Stern deciding who advances each week. But come November 8th, you vote for the ultimate winner while sitting on your sofa, with a cocktail in one hand and your iPhone in the other. What could be more American than that? Admit it, the longer this chapter gets, the less crazy my idea seems. It's actually so simple, I'm beginning to get chicken skin. Let's be honest. The bright side of it all is no more politicians. They'll be the first people voted off the island or not handed a rose or however it is we end up signifying losses. Because it's TV, celebrities will rule the roost, which I consider progress. After all, if Trump can run the country, why can't Halle Berry? I tune in to watch her press conferences in full any day of the week. Which brings us back to square one, the audience. Listen, we really don't suck. Our better nature will win out. Like Winston Churchill once said, you can always trust Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. Some of us are living in the modern world, and some of us are stuck back in the days when Winston first said that, circa 1942. We need to drag these people into 2018, probably the hard way. Achievement has no color. Abraham Lincoln. USA. USA. Racism is not only alive, it's very much thriving on social media and beyond. Because the one beautiful thing about racists is they can't stop exercising their freedom of speech. Every ounce of idiot juice inside their ignorant little brains has to eventually be squeezed out and spoken aloud, or tweeted, or posted online. Thank God. Years ago, I said something that's come to follow me around on the internet, in memes, and various other media. Racism isn't born, folks. It's taught. I have a 2-year-old son. Know what he hates? Naps. End of list. I'm no genius. I was just reflecting on the beauty of my young son's approach to life. He didn't care what color his friends were. He cared about what color their toys were and how long they could all play with them before the much-dreaded afternoon nap invaded their imaginations. I was a kid during the 60s, witnessing Martin Luther King's peaceful battle for civil rights on TV and made highly aware of how to treat others based on a tool my immigrant parents educated us with. Judge everyone as an individual. There was a great story on the news this year about a little white kid whose best friend was black. Jax, the white kid, and Reddy, his black friend, both decided to get the same haircut so their kindergarten teacher wouldn't be able to tell them apart. It was one of those moments that make you swoon over the innocence and purity of children. For my son's generation, as well as the one Jax and Reddy are a part of, all men truly are created equal. Their actions reflect friendship based on content of character, not skin color. They have grown up with a black president in office for 8 years, which was a major accomplishment for this country. Let's face it, we've always been great. Complicated, yes. Imperfect, you bet your ass. But the thing that makes us great is our striving to become perfect, always moving forward to try and solve our problems and right our wrongs. So when I heard the motto, "Make America Great Again," my first reaction was, what the fuck is Trump talking about? It sounded like if he had a time machine, it would magically transport us back to a period when things were perfect in this country. But he's only 10 years older than me, so when exactly would that be? In 1948, when he was 2 years old? The early 50s during the McCarthy hearings and the beginning of the Cold War? Maybe it was the 60s when assassinations, race riots, and the generation gap tore the nation in half. Then again, he could be referring to the herpes-free, pre-AIDS 1970s me decade, when disco ruled and you only had to wait in line for 7 hours to fill your car with gas. Or the trickle-down economics 80s, when the rich got richer and the poor got crack. It's definitely not the 90s, when the country flourished financially, because no Republican wants to credit a Democrat who finally balanced the federal budget and thought it entitled him to free head. I like to call this approach Americanomics, the belief that we can recreate some great aspect of the past if the right person is put in charge. But it's just another haul of horse shit. Trump's not bringing back manufacturing jobs because Chinese factories will always be cheaper. Coal miners can rejoice as Trump pulls back Obama's environmental rules, but their jobs are being stolen by machines that don't have lungs. Trump will tax cut this and deregulate that and make a big splash out of signing the paperwork. It actually makes zero mathematical sense, but the pronouncements play well at arena rallies. He's basically become the head Cheeto of his own cheering masses, loud, puffed up, and full of orange air. I've been living in America for almost 6 full decades, and it always gets better as we go along. If you gave me a time machine, I wouldn't go backward at all. I already did 1977. Sure, you could fuck whoever you wanted without a condom, but there was always a shitty Bee Gees tune setting the mood. No thanks. I'd go forward, knowing this country would be even better no matter what year I picked. Because America is an amoeba. ever-changing, ever-morphing, ever-alive, with the food, music, and ideas brought to this country from numerous other nations. Some of us may gaze upon the Statue of Liberty as an old iron lady. Like Hillary jokingly said, Donald Trump looks at the Statue of Liberty and sees a 4, maybe a 5, if she loses the torch. I still see Lady Liberty as my mom and dad first did when passing by her on a boat as they arrived in New York Harbor from Ireland back in the 1950s, full of promise and potential, welcoming every color, creed, and creative impulse. The problem with Make America Great Again was its resonance with a lot of people in this country who don't like progress, or black people, or Jews. As I said earlier, the only color Trump can see is green, and whatever that shade of tanning cream is that he plasters on his puss, but his loud and brash campaign appearances and nostalgic motto caught the attention of some assholes who decided this was the perfect opportunity to tout their own out-of-date throwback tendencies, one of which was good old-fashioned American racism. Let's be clear. We're not talking about questionable racism, like calling someone who offered even the tiniest criticism of Obama's economic policies a racist, or saying that if you boo a black shortstop after he strikes out for the third straight time, you're a racist. We're talking blatant, on-camera, 1963-style hatred and stupidity. It's awful and ugly and unforgivable. But my approach is this. If you're going to be a hater, by all means, be honest and upfront about it. Don't be like the Arizona house painter George Lindell, who fervently and repeatedly chanted "Jew-S-A, Jew-S-A" at the media pool during a Trump rally last year. In full view of a press bullpen jammed with cameras, George screamed and jabbed the air with his Make America Great Again signs and Hillary for Prison t-shirt on proud display. After the videos went viral, George went back on camera the next day, beer and cigarette in hand, to claim he worked with a lot of Mexicans and liked the way they pronounced the U in USA as Jew and decided to pay tribute to them in public. "I'm around Mexican people all the time," George explained. "I speak Spanish a lot. That's my lingo. It's just the way I say it. It had nothing to do with the Jews. You media people are so paranoid." Nice try, Georgie. Say what you want about David Duke, but he would never use Mexican house painters to explain away an anti-Semitic Jewish media rant. He's too busy hating black people. But karma's a bitch, which is why David Duke's facelift makes it look like he's creating a master race of 67-year-old lesbians. The Arizona rally video actually shows George pointing at reporters and camera operators, shouting, "You're going down. You're the enemy. You're the ones working for the devil. We're run by the Jews, okay? Yeah!" And the spin he put on his story turned into a hanging curveball, because the so-called Jewish media hit a home run when they found George's Facebook page, upon which, around the same time, he posted, "War with Russia? Sounds like a good time to shoot American Democrats in the back or face." Under the name of his company, Lindell Paints, on the Alex Jones website Infowars.com, there were several uses of the word nigger and harsh talk like this. "It's not murder when you kill a nigger. It's animal abuse, which is sometimes needed. Just look at your own dog." He at first denied writing those comments, saying they were composed by his helpers, but then said he supported them one way or another before taking down the business page and erasing his Facebook presence. Here's a headline you probably saw coming. George denies that he's a racist, or that he hates Jews and black people. In his final appearance in front of the cameras, he said, "The human race is just one race, dumbass. Niggers is a word in the English language. Do you know how popular that word was in 1902? I guess we know which year George would travel back to if he ever got his hands on that time machine. George also said he lives near a lot of black people, with whom he gets along fine. Not to mention Jews. "I happen to fucking love the Jews," he said. "Most of my customers are Jews." Not anymore, they ain't. It's got a blow to carry that much hate and deception around in your heart every day. As a Boston sports fan, I hate the New York Yankees, the Montreal Canadiens, and the Los Angeles Lakers. But it's not based on the color of their skin, it's the color of their uniforms. And during the playoffs, I can get overheated about it. But a guy like George, he's got to feel that heat times 10,000 every single waking moment of every single day. To paraphrase an old saying, it's not the hate that gets you, it's the fake humility. George's Trump rally rants reflect the old-school racist belief that the media is run by big-brain Jewish billionaires with an axe to grind. Let's examine that idea for a second. The major shareholder of the New York Times is a Mexican zillionaire named Carlos Slim Helú. He's a Maronite Catholic Christian. Television and media giant Liberty Media is owned by Irish-American John Malone. Warren Buffett is an agnostic. Rupert Murdoch's father was a Presbyterian, and he has often dabbled with the idea of becoming a Catholic. I could go on and on, but why bother? Let's instead focus on the rabid chanting of USA, USA, that so inspired George's Jew-baiting reinterpretation and was the rolling thunder cry at all of Trump's campaign rallies. It arose from the desire for America to be number one again. In fact, we are number one in quite a few areas. Experts have done the math, and the stats don't lie, ladies and gentlemen. Mass shootings? We are not only number one, but so far ahead of numbers 2 through 10 that even combined, they can't compete with us. And guns? Not even close. We've been number one in manufacturing them for decades, and we're only making more guns and bullets and bombs. We have more guns than anyone else on Earth. Serbia comes in second, but almost 40 percentage points behind. Yemen is third and 72 points back. Suck on our spent shell casings, bitches. And you'll never guess what else we lead the world in. Nothing. That's right. Zip. Zilch. Nada. According to a vast study of world power and performance called Best Countries Rankings, compiled annually by the consulting firm Young & Rubicam's Bav Lab and the Wharton Business School, we ain't what we used to be. Wharton is, of course, our current president's alma mater, the school so often mentioned whenever Trump talks about how smart he is. So I think we can trust their findings in what might as well be called the actual Olympics. Sure, we win a ton of gold medals when we run track, ski, swim, and skate, but in real life, we can barely win a bronze. In overall performance, we come in 7th place, which may sound bad, but means, hey, at least we still make the playoffs. In best country for women, we place 16th, just squeaking into the postseason. Inclusiveness, 17th, but still in the wild card race. Quality of life, we barely beat Portugal for 18th and early golf. Best country for kids, we are 19th with no participation trophies. Attracting investment from other countries, we finish 35th, behind fucking Uruguay, and have to pay for the rebuilding year ourselves. Healthcare, 50th. That's not a mistake. We finish 50th. Don't Google numbers 1 through 49. It will only make you sick, which could literally cost you an arm and a leg under Trobamacare, plus your house. There are some bright spots. Entrepreneurship, we take the bronze behind Germany and Japan. Cultural influence, we also get bronze after Italy and France. In racism, we nab the number 5 spot, which is better than finishing first, unless, of course, you're George or David. Then you're pissed off. More good news. In the category of worst airports in the world, we place silver, Newark, bronze, LaGuardia, and 4th place, JFK. And in the highest rate of diabetes category, we get the gold, just barely beating out Malta and Singapore. Whew, that one was close, but on an annual basis, ice cream kills more Americans than ISIS ever has. Forget the terror attacks. Just send us a free supply of Chubby Hubby. 10 years from now, boom, diabetes bomb. And here's some more good news. In drug abuse and dependency, we finish 8th overall. But in prescription drug abuse, we grab the gold for biggest opioid addiction. OSA. OSA. Let's hear George chant that. With the exception of KKK members and other dedicated public white supremacists, your average everyday racist never really believes he or she is one. They couch it in politically correct terminology or fold it into sociological concerns. Then again, how many times has a moron walked up to you and said, sorry, I'm a total fucking moron, after acting like one? And how many times have you seen a douchebag raise his hand and say, hey, everyone, I'm a giant douche? Answer, not once, ever. George may think because he works with Mexicans and adopted their language, it makes him a mensch. It doesn't. It makes him a racist in 2 different languages. Let's go deeper on the Jew-SA idea. Studies show that only 7 million Jewish people live in the United States, and that 2.5 million of those live in the New York / New Jersey area. USA? Sorry, Georgie, but based on the numbers, that antique fanaticism ain't ever gonna fly. But New York is a distinct possibility and has always been a celebrated sobriquet for the Big Apple. The many contributions of its Jewish citizens are one reason why New York has always led the world in offering up true comic genius and elegantly intelligent ideas. like not being a bigot. As for the rabid anti-immigrant and pure white pride approach to current life in this country, that's a despotic dream that guys like George need to let go of, because it's already dead. Here's the most recent chart explaining the 21st century makeup of the American populace. From the 2010 Federal Population Ancestry Census. Number 1, German, 50 million. Number 2, African, 45 million. Number 3, Irish, 35 million. Number 4, Mexican, 32 million. Number 5, English, 27 million. Number 6, American, 20 million. Number 7, Italian, 17 million. Number 8, Polish, 10 million. Number 9, French, 9 million. Number 10, Scottish, 6 million. Tied for 11th are Scotch-Irish with 5 million and Native/Alaskan with 5 million. That's right, George. Germans apparently rule the roost in America by 5 million people. German SA. German SA. Meh, doesn't sound that great. Matter of fact, it sounds vaguely like one of Hitler's secret military branches, for which George and his ilk might actually march in a parade. Oi. You know what sounds better? ASA, the African States of America. They finished in a very close second place. But the truth is, there are probably 20 million illegal Mexicans running around, so if you add them in with their registered American citizen ancestors, we're talking first place with over 50 million total. USM. USM. That actually has a nice ring to it. And by the time of the 2020 census, may technically be true. Plus, George knows the language already, so he should make out fine in the United States of Mexico. He could teach them all about 1902. The group I'm most curious about is the one at number 6, Americans. Nobody is really just American. We all originally came from somewhere else. Only one of the groups tied for 11th place, Native and Alaskan Americans, can claim ownership to this land before the rest of us rolled in on boats, waving European weapons and planting empire flags. But 20 million of us chose to do what my dad did back in chapter 1. Drop all the other qualifiers and label themselves with a single word, which reflects their pride about having either moved here themselves or being the progeny of someone who did. Conquering oceans and mountains, deserts and despotic regimes, economic distress, repressive governments, murderous movements, and any number of other odds. No matter the obstacle, freedom remains a powerful beacon. For decades, many Cubans made the 103-mile trip to Florida after spending 7 days in the searing sun on rafts made out of items like patched-up old inner tubes, surrounded by the most shark-infested waters on the planet, eating nuts and berries. And you think a wall is going to keep these people out? Or a travel ban? Not unless you can also ban ladders and tunnel digging, along with pole vaulting and catapults, plus ingenuity, not to mention the human spirit. This isolationist attitude, undercut with a vaguely xenophobic hope that somehow cement can keep crime and drugs at bay, is a modern-day unicorn, full of reductive delight. Drug lords are in a zillion-dollar supply and demand business. As long as their best customers live here, they will find another way in. Criminals go where the cash flow leads them. When someone famously asked Willie Sutton why he kept robbing banks, his answer was, because that's where they keep the money. I like immigration. It's how my parents came here. Plus, I'm not ready to give up any of the good ideas immigrants introduced to America, because their track record on that over the years is pretty fucking impressive. Cannolis, tacos, canishes, croissants, pasta, egg rolls, french fries, pierogi, pizza, sausage, bratwurst, sushi, muffins, beer, scotch, tequila, vodka, whiskey, lager, jazz, blues, rock, hip-hop, and every show tune ever written. Cars, planes, trucks, trains, TV, radio, film, laptops, iPhones, and photography. Life would suck without this stuff. Once again, I'm not interested in reversing time, because there have always been those who firmly believe they should be the last new people allowed to enter this land, going right back to the original settlers who fought like hell to keep other explorers out. Think about that. If we had stopped immigration right after the pilgrims landed, we'd still be eating maize and buffalo jerky 3 times a day and telling long stories around the campfire at night. Pass me the fucking firewater, chief. But Trump's still adamant about his wall solving Mexican immigration, our drug problems, and crime. So let's examine this monstrosity. First off, it's been described as a wall, but even Trump has admitted that some of it may need to be a fence. Other Republicans have described it as a wall with sections that would be a, quote, wall-like fence, unquote. Still others have termed parts of it a fence-like wall. So how much is this fancy wall or wallish fence or fall or whence actually going to cost? Well, we're talking 1,954 miles, minus 652 miles that already have barriers. Those barriers consist of walls and fences that cost $2.3 billion to build 15 years ago. So we're left with roughly 1,300 miles that need coverage. In June 2016, Trump estimated that his 50-foot-high concrete wall would cost $8 billion and take 2 years to build. In July, the Bernstein Research Group studied the situation in depth, concluding it would cost between $15 and $25 billion and take 7 years to erect. Trump must have thought that was fake news because in October, he updated his estimate to $12 billion in 2.5 years. By February, he was claiming a $15 billion price tag and 3.5 years. We haven't even broken ground yet, and already this thing has almost doubled in price and time. Several construction experts from the states involved expressed concern about the situation due to their experience with local permits and personnel expenses. Trump's team forged ahead, confident in their aims and buoyed by the energetic response of their supporters for what a bold leader is capable of doing with a patriotic focus and a fistful of power. Let's review one example of what happens when the federal government decides to work with state and city officials to pull off such a monumental task. The Central Artery / Tunnel Project in Boston, Massachusetts. Its unofficial title was the Big Dig, and it involved tearing down the ancient expressway in downtown Boston, replacing it with an underground tunnel system and, above it, a cityscape of grass and parkland crisscrossed with updated city streets. It was one of the last deals worked out between Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, joining federal money and altruism with state necessities and local expertise to prove they could all solve one of America's growing issues, failing infrastructure. It would ultimately combine a tunnel named after the iconic baseball and military hero Ted Williams with one named for Tip O'Neill himself, plus a greenway dedicated to former first mom, Rose Kennedy. It would be the biggest and most expensive federal road construction project in the history of the United States, scheduled to take 7 years at a cost of $2.8 billion. And guess what? They did it. They built the modern equivalent of the Roman aqueducts, and not only did it reduce traffic, it made the downtown area a beautiful and much more accessible place. It made international news and attracted unlimited media attention. It made Boston synonymous with federal solutions for state and city issues. And it only took 17 years and $22 billion. You heard that right. 10 years longer than estimated at almost 10 times the cost. The project was plagued from day one by design flaws, poor execution, escalating prices, schedule overruns, unexplained delays, substandard materials, and massive corruption. In other words, it was just like everything else Washington decides to do. And it only covers 3.5 miles of land. You heard that right. It's only 3.5 miles long, and we use Mexicans to help build it. 3.5 miles is 0.26923076923077% of 1,300 miles. I'm no math genius, folks. I Googled the percentage. But how long do you think it would really take our government to build a cement structure that runs from California to Texas after they spent almost 2 decades building one that runs from downtown Boston to downtown fucking Boston? Here's my answer. Forever. And by forever, I mean at least 15 years and $50 billion. Or $940,203,083,866 pesos, which is what Mexico will supposedly pay us for our efforts. By the time it's done, Trump's youngest son, Barron, will be old enough to run for office and collect our cash from south of his daddy's wally fence, Albatross. Congressman Barron Trump will be in charge of a 20% tariff his father wants to place on all Mexican imports to the USA. Let's take a look at what that includes. Mexico provides us with 93% of our avocados, 71% of our tomatoes, and $1.3 billion worth of our beer, plus 80% of our tequila, and about half of our Coca-Cola, not to mention a ton of our snacks. I know we could easily give all that up, right? And these. Most of our truck and automobile tires and engine parts. and vehicle parts, as well as whole vehicles from Nissan, Honda, and Volkswagen, as well as all Cadillac Escalades, Chevy Silverados, Dodge Ram trucks, and Ford Fusion cars. Plus, every G5, Gulfstream, and Learjet, and most of our plasma TVs. Also a shitload of important computer and cell phone parts, the final pieces before the devices are delivered to market, and medical instruments, and refrigerators, as well as most of our air conditioning units and Fender Stratocaster guitars, 70% of all our vegetables, and 41% of our fruit, and, irony of all ironies, most of our cement supply, which we need to build the wall. Wow. So just to put it in perspective, we will actually be paying higher prices for almost everything we eat, drive, watch, and talk into on a daily basis, including the main ingredient we need to build the wall that is aimed at protecting us. This may go down as the single most idiotic idea in immigration history. We're going to make Mexico raise the prices on products we buy from them to pay for a wall we already used our money and their cement to build. Call me crazy, but it sounds like we're getting fucked. Twice, maybe even three times. Why don't we just build the wall out of pickup trucks and Stratocasters? Throw in the odd refrigerator every couple of miles so you can grab a cold Corona on either side. The mayor of Brownsville, Texas, the town where the wall would end, is Democrat Tony Martinez. His take on the project? Quote, nearly impossible, unquote. Republican Representative Will Hurd, whose district includes 800 miles of the Texas border, says, quote, it will be impossible and also the most expensive and least effective way to secure the border, unquote. I could quote more local opinions from experts in the terrain bordering Mexico, including deserts, wetlands, mountains, rivers, grasslands, and forests, but you get the point. It's the Ted Williams Tunnel times 20 fucking 5, with bipartisan critics who live along the line. Hey, if Trump really wants to fund a foolish notion with our money, why not use one of his signature phrases and go bigly? Fuck the wall. Let's build a bubble. A giant, bulletproof, plexiglass bubble that bombs and bad weather can't penetrate. Just like the bubbles on top of arcade table hockey games, it would cover the entire country. No one gets in, nobody gets out. Studies show that most Americans have very little interest in foreign vacations anymore, and the ones that do, they can still watch the Travel Channel. The Bad Hombre Bubble Project, that's my title, will take 2 years from start to finish and only cost us $10 billion. How do I know that? Because I just made it up, which is essentially what most politicians do. But people are going to love my BHB hats and buttons. And if Trump's wall isn't built by 2020, I could run against him wearing both and probably win by touting my big, beautiful see-through bubble. Think of the possibilities. Plenty of sun, but no rain or snow. No future 9/11 type attacks. And no more pesky tourists. BHB. BHB. I bet we lead the world in stupid chanting, which would suck. But nobody's ever measured that particular statistic, so there isn't any proof. Thank God. But let me remind everyone about something great that America has always been the undisputed champion of. Charity. Giving time and money to help others. Donating hard cash and tender caring. Literally our blood, sweat, and tears. This is an area in which nobody can compete with us. Shit. I just Googled top 10 most charitable countries, and we're officially not number one anymore. Myanmar is. A place that sounds like it's named after marshmallow-filled candy. But that's okay, because we're still the number one most positive place on the planet. Fuck. I just Googled 10 most positive countries, and we come in ninth. Jesus, behind Singapore and Germany. What the hell? This is really bumming me out. Listen, it's not a problem because I'm positive we are still the most positive place in the Western Hemisphere. God damn it, just Google that. It's Canada, probably because there's more alcohol in their beer. Okay, so we're the second most positive place in the Western Hemisphere, and that's fine. Motherfucker, you're not going to believe this. It's Cuba. They're all happy as hell because Castro finally kicked the bucket. Still not a problem. Here's what we're going to do. There are only 54 million people in Malabar and barely 11 million in Cuba, so I'm declaring victory based purely on population. I mean, I've got at least 10 million Irish-American cousins, and they all become extremely happy big tippers after a few Jamesons. So let's call it all a draw. As of right now, Dr. Dennis Leary says we are the most positive and charitable people on this big blue and white marble. We don't want to pay for your health care, yet if your house gets crushed in an earthquake, we will pull you out and hand you a sandwich. It might be a Big Mac, but hey, You were just trapped under a house. I don't think this is the time to start counting calories. Great things happen every day in this country. Many of them are achieved by people standing on the shoulders of their parents, grandparents, and the founding fathers. Meanwhile, every day, more new faces arrive. Poor, tired masses yearning to breathe free and stake their claim to the American dream. A wall won't keep them out. A bubble won't hold them in. To paraphrase Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will still come, under it or over it, or even right through it. You can't legislate courage away from a heart. You can't outlaw desire deep in a soul. But when you welcome both, brilliance is born. The Americans in the next chapter are examples of what happens when dreams meet reality. And what will always keep us number one in the category of most sought after place to live. A people that values its privileges above its principles soon loses both. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Red, White, and True. It has been my pleasure in this life to meet many people who have become inspirational figures for me. People who make this country not suck every single day. I've written a lot about my parents in the past and even in these pages. There isn't a day that goes by without something they taught me through their words or actions coming back to help illuminate the present. My wife Anne is a daily beacon of light who makes me laugh and solves any problem, big or small, with common sense and a clear moral compass. But there are other friends and family members who not only make my life better for being in it, but make America better by virtue of how they live theirs. A few of them are famous, the rest of them should be, for all the right reasons. One day in 1991, Michael J. Fox was still riding the high of a huge Hollywood acting career. Gifted with the rare combination of good looks and astonishing comic timing, he had won well-deserved Emmys for his role as Alex Keaton on the smash sitcom Family Ties, and his Back to the Future film trilogy had manufactured billions of box office dollars while making audiences all over the planet laugh out loud. He noticed a twitch in one of his pinky fingers and wrote it off as the result of some stunt work gone wrong. Mike was also a good athlete, Canadian-born and raised with a hockey stick in his hands and skates on both feet. Fast, nimble, and built low to the ground, his secret weapon on and off the ice had always been people who underestimated his ability based on physical size. That all changed when doctors diagnosed that pinky twitch as the first sign of Parkinson's disease. Mike responded to the news the way I would have, by drinking himself into oblivion. How was it possible that such a successful, smart, funny, and physically capable guy could get hit with news like that at age 29? The answer? Parkinson's doesn't discriminate. His wife, Tracy Pollan, focused his energy back onto their young family, and soon Mike had not only sought help to quit drinking, but learned as much as he could about the other disease his body was now burdened by. Adopting the motto, you don't die from Parkinson's, you die with it, he formed the Michael J. Fox Foundation and dedicated himself to finding a cure. Since 2000, the foundation has become the largest nonprofit funder of Parkinson's research in the world, investing more than $650 million so far. And to think that all of this started with a speedy little skater from Vancouver who happens to be one of the funniest motherfuckers I've ever known. Once Mike and I were on vacation together and headed to the gym. We hadn't seen each other in a while, and I noticed he was still in really great shape. What are you doing for cardio these days? I asked. Mike replied, I'm doing a lot of shaking. It's called the Parkinson's workout. It took me a few minutes to catch my breath as I stood on the beach laughing my ass off. That's the thing about Mike that never ceases to amaze me. His sense of timing is impeccable, but his ability to accept bad circumstances and adapt them into positive results is truly remarkable. And he turned that point of view into several best-selling books, sharing his hopeful approach with the rest of the world, most notably in his acclaimed memoir, Always Looking Up, the writing of which took its toll. As with any book and any author, Mike found himself mired in a bout of writer's block and grunting angrily around the apartment until Tracy asked him what was wrong. He answered in this fashion, I'm never going to finish my book about fucking optimism. It was Tracy's laughter at that self-pity that finally turned him around. He finished the book. He went on to win more Emmys after starring on Rescue Me and The Good Wife. He continues to conquer Parkinson's one day at a time. and to be one of my favorite people who ever walked this earth. Because of all the titles attached to his world-famous name, actor, producer, author, and activist, the most important one to him is Dad. During his Hall of Fame National Hockey League career, Cam Neely virtually invented the position now known as the power forward. He was 6'2" and 220 pounds of pure muscle. Traded from his hometown Vancouver Canucks to the Boston Bruins in 1986, Cam flourished as a first-line right wing. Hockey fans in Boston and around the world fell in love with this ferocious, full-speed, all-heart style of play. Multiple All-Star team selections pointed to a razor scoring touch, coupled with the devastating body checks that made Cam's presence on the ice a scary problem for opponents to cope with. He once scored 50 goals in only 44 games, a feat surpassed only by Wayne Gretzky. He could shoot, score, and kill you in the corners. But while being lauded in the sports world and considered a hockey icon, off the ice, Cam was dealing with an enemy he never saw coming. In 1987, his mother Marlene was diagnosed with colon cancer, to which she ultimately succumbed at the young age of 47. Just a few years later, his father Michael was diagnosed with a brain tumor and passed away in 1993 at age 56. Suddenly, Cam found all his wealth, talent, and fame useless against the disease that was ravaging his family. In 1994, he decided to do something about it and started the Cam Neely Foundation for Cancer Care. The first goal was to gather enough money to build the Neely House at Tufts Medical Center in downtown Boston, a special wing of that hospital devoted to helping patients and their families have the ultimate comfort and care while being tended to by many of the world's finest cancer specialists. By 1997, the Neely House was up and running. By the year 2000, it had expanded to over 16,000 square feet. In the 22 years since its inception, the foundation has moved even further into finding and financing a cure. Other avenues that Cam's work has opened include the Neely Center for Clinical Cancer Research, the Neely Cell Therapy and Collection Center, the Neely Pediatric Bone Marrow Transplant Unit, the Michael Neely Center for Brain Tumor Care and Research, and the Marlene Neely Endoscopy Suite. All of these spaces and the amazing work being done in them are dedicated to the memory of his parents. The Neely House has lovingly housed over 7,000 families during the last two decades to make life easier as they battle the disease. It even touched the comedy community when Jimmy Fallon's father was successfully treated there. The research side of the foundation continues to make breakthroughs and expand. Inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2005, Cam is a unanimous first ballot inductee into the Humanity Hall of Fame whenever they decide to open one. He brought the grit, grace, power, and multi-tool ability of his hockey career to the battle against cancer, and it's never stopped paying off. I've played hockey with and against Cam, and let me tell you something. With is way better. His competitive drive and fierce desire to win overcome every obstacle when he is on the ice. The wrist shot that made him Patrick Waugh's least favorite attacker is deadly accurate. The body size that made him such a hurricane on skates fills you with fear. And the look in his eyes when he wants to win makes your feet somehow suddenly race for the bench. Let me give you a hockey example of why this guy inspires me. One winter, Cam, Mike Fox, a close friend of ours named Jim Pallotta, and I decided to play two-on-two hockey. This particular morning, the weatherman said it was 5 degrees outside with a wind chill factor that made it feel like -7. Of course, to maniacs like us, a wind chill of -7 means just one thing. It's pond hockey time. Jim's an Italian-American with working-class roots in Boston's famed North End and a fantastic athlete. We were on a trip with our wives and had brought our hockey bags along. So out on a frozen sheet of midwinter Vermont ice, it was strictly old-school hockey. No helmets, just shin guards and gloves. We paired up as USA versus Canada in a best-of-7 series. First team to hit a small wooden log in the net 5 times wins each match. The advantage was definitely in Team USA's favor. Jim and I were both healthy and in great skating shape. Cam was hampered by a severely arthritic right hip, which would soon have to be replaced, and a balky knee that limited his turning radius. And Mike, of course, had Parkinson's. But the air was crisp, the sky was blue, and the friendships ran deep as we skated back and forth for 6 fun games, laughing and hustling to a 3-3 tie. We could have stopped there. It had been a great 2 hours. We were all getting hungry, and it was easy to see that Cam was in pain and Mike's medication was wearing off. That's when Cam said, "You good to go, Mike?" Cam had that famous look in his eyes, and it lit Mike up. "Oh, yeah, I'm ready to roll," Mike responded. "Game 7, right now," Cam barked. "Let's go." And go we did. Right from the opening face-off, Jim and I were on our heels as the thought of losing transformed Team Canada into a tornado. Cam was barreling around, blocking shots and racing after rebounds. Jim and I were struggling to get close to their net. We could see how limited Cam's skating range was, but his will to win wiped out the ache in his hip and leg. Meanwhile, Mike had turned into a Parkinson's-infused water bug. It's hard enough to cover small, fast guys in any contact sport. You can't hit what you can't catch. But it's absolutely impossible to read which direction an angry Parkinson's patient on skates is going to go. Head fakes and eye fakes are part of any hockey player's arsenal of tricks when carrying the puck, but Fox had so many moves going on at once that he almost sent my brain into seizures. His elbow twitches, leg spasms, shoulder shakes, and hand flutters had me reacting like a confused and uncoordinated rag doll. Pallotta turned into an NHL defenseman, sliding and diving to stop shots, stealing the puck, and making impossible tape-to-tape passes to me. Neely was doing the same at Canada's end of the ice, sending Mike Fox flying for our net. They went up 3-2 until Jim and I tied it. Then they went up 4-3 until Jimmy scored again. Now, it was basically sudden-death overtime. Team USA was sucking cold wind. Team Canada was doing the same. Again, we could have called it right there. But instead, I stole the puck from Cam and was headed up ice toward Mike Fox on defense when boom! I suddenly found myself flying through the air and bam! Stuck face first in a snowbank. The result of an arthritic hip check from Cam, who now had the puck and saucered a ridiculously beautiful pass over Jim's outstretched stick that Mike one-timed into the wooden log for the game-winning goal. I swept the snow off my face as Cam raised his hands like he just won the Stanley Cup. Final score in the series? Canada 4, USA 3. That drive to conquer all odds is the reason Cam thinks one day the final score in his fight against the disease that stole his parents will be Neely Foundation 4, Cancer Nothing. It's also how, as president of the Boston Bruins, he steered the team to a Stanley Cup victory in 2011. Just like on that day in Vermont, this guy never gives up the fight. Dear Cancer, better keep your fucking head on a swivel. Cam Neely's got your number. In the weeks following the 9/11 attacks on New York City, Jane Rosenthal and her business partner Robert De Niro dealt with its aftermath on a daily basis. Their company, Tribeca Productions, was located a few blocks from the World Trade Center site, and De Niro not only still lived in the neighborhood, but was born there and had grown up walking those very same streets. As the air slowly began to clear and the digging for lost souls continued, Jane and Bob watched as local businesses began to suffer. Restaurants and bars, art galleries and clothing stores, small markets and coffee shops were on the verge of closing forever as customers dwindled and the tourist trade disappeared. People were no longer visiting downtown Manhattan, some due to fear and others by assuming nothing was open. I was down there a lot in those days, and I can tell you firsthand how silent the streets were and how odd it was to sit in a restaurant where almost all of the other tables were empty. Night after night, day after day. Except for the ongoing recovery work at Ground Zero, Tribeca was a ghost town. Little Italy was deserted. Chinatown had no customers. So Jane and Bob decided to do something about the situation. Not because they had to, but because they wanted to. Engaging the help of Jane's husband at the time, Craig Hatkoff, the trio called in a bevy of celebrity friends and announced a restaurant crawl through downtown. Diners would show up at different establishments and eat side by side with famous people as they helped to spread the word that these great places were not only still open, but in dire need of financial salvation. Bob stopped in at each place to personally greet everyone and take pictures. Jane made sure the timing came off without a hitch. The press showed up to take photographs and write about the event. And it worked. Soon, people from all over Manhattan were streaming south and helping to save businesses belonging to their fellow New Yorkers. Using this opportunity on an even bigger scale, a month later, Jane, Craig, and Bob decided to start the Tribeca Film Festival, launching it with little more than a dream and their cell phones. Again, not because they had to, but because they wanted to. Working endlessly, calling in favors from all ends of the film world, reaching out to corporations and business connections for sponsorship and support. They quickly mounted a program of movies, speaking appearances, musical performances, and celebrity red carpets that filled up a week's worth of festivities. Debuting in the spring of 2003, it was an immediate success, drawing even more attention and money to the neighborhood's recovery. At once exhausted and excited about what only a few months previously had seemed an impossible task, the trio decided to make the festival an annual event. 15 years later, it's not only one of the world's leading annual film celebrations, it has grown to include television and all forms of digital communication technology, and is responsible for rejuvenating downtown New York and bringing over $900 million back into the city's economy. But Jane and Bob didn't stop there. They joined forces with other city luminaries to raise funds for the National 9/11 Memorial and Museum, devoting even more time and energy to that cause as board members and helping to complete one of the most moving and detailed tributes to those who gave their lives on that horrible day. It took more than 10 years to complete, but I can tell you as someone who has walked through it, the experience is not only unforgettable, but also holds a special healing power. The Tribeca Film Festival happens each and every spring in downtown Manhattan. The National 9/11 Memorial and Museum is open every day in the shadow of One World Trade Center, also known as the Freedom Tower. Jane and Bob's Tribeca Productions is still located in its original building a few blocks away, in the same neighborhood their charitable spirit helped save. Not because they had to, only because they wanted to. In the summer of 1995, Lenny Clark was a miracle of modern science, addicted to cocaine and yet weighing 388 pounds. He could suck down half a gram and an entire pizza in less than 30 minutes, which he did on an almost daily basis. Needless to say, Lenny was not a scientist. One of comedy's shooting stars back in the late 80s, performing in sold-out arenas with Sam Kinison and headlining his own critically acclaimed eponymous CBS sitcom, he had adopted Sam's drug and food habits as his own. The two of them even started a temporary food and drug delivery service when their show business mentor, Rodney Dangerfield, was forced into a weight loss clinic by his third wife. Sam and Lenny would sneak pizza, weed, and blow to Rodney through a side alley door each evening. They were the angels of evil. But ultimately for Lenny, marrying his own coke dealer and spending money as if there was no tomorrow led to heartbreak and financial problems that he couldn't overcome once his TV show got canceled. Sam's tragic early death in an automobile accident only sent him further out on the limb of edgy behavior. His drinking became uncontrollable, and the cocaine and food electrons that fired through his woozy brain now read as inconceivable science fiction. An entire gram of blow, followed by a hotel room service tray of 5 shrimp cocktails, 2 orders of French fries, 3 filet mignons that he ate like meat donuts, plus a serving bowl full of whipped cream and 2 containers of Haagen-Dazs, any flavor. All followed by one of his famed medical inventions, the NyQuil Stinger. I was around for the creation of that particular prescription back in 1982. It was Lenny's solution for falling asleep after a long night of cocaine abuse. We lived on the same block, and many a night I was the designated driver as we headed home from a comedy gig. One time, Lenny made me stop at a 24-hour pharmacy as he purchased 2 bottles of NyQuil. When I asked him who had the cold, he said, "Me. I got the cocaine flu, but half a bottle of this mixed with 4 fingers of whiskey, and I'll not only sleep like a baby, but when I wake up tomorrow, my sinuses will be crystal clear." Ladies and gentlemen, meet Dr. Lenny Clark. There are a ton of insane stories about Lenny floating around out there, and I'm here to tell you that every single one of them is true. At age 15, he set the single-season record for sneaking into Fenway Park 37 times, which is amazing, given how loud and rambunctious Lenny is at any sporting event. The ushers must have been deaf. At age 18, he was a fantastic football player and a straight C-minus student with little hope for a college scholarship. One of his sisters was engaged to a black guy Lenny looked up to, who informed him that he'd gotten a full college ride based on affirmative action. So Lenny, a quick learner in spite of his grade point average, filled out a state college application. Next to the question asking his ethnicity, he listed African American. And sure enough, got a full ride. Nobody seemed to notice that fall as he settled in on campus and kept a low profile. Everything was going fine until he decided to run for president of the freshman class. Now you know why he got all those C minuses. At age 20, he applied to be a lead paint inspector in his hometown of Cambridge, Massachusetts, basing his qualification for the job on the fact that he'd eaten tons of lead paint chips as a small child in the house.